This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Paul Ekman is a psychologist who specializes in reading, but not in reading books or journals or case studies. He reads people's faces and has devoted his life to understanding and analyzing why people react in certain ways when they're not telling the truth. Oliver Sacks calls Ekman the most astute analyst of emotion since Darwin. And in these days of high security checkpoints and concerns about terrorism, Ekman's theories and observations are in strong demand. He's worked as consultant on emotional expression for the FBI and the CIA, and for Pixar and Industrial Light and Magic, where he's advised animators on how to create more lifelike expressions for their characters. Ekman is author of an earlier book, Telling Lies. His new book is called Emotions Revealed: Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. Terry spoke with Ekman earlier this week.
What types of facial expressions do you think are shared among all humans? We're all wired to use this facial expression to express certain emotions.
There are seven that they're really very good evidence for. Fear, anger, sadness, and anguish, which is sort of the other side of sadness. Disgust. Contempt, which is a word that we have a hard time hearing in English. It sounds like content, but I mean the feeling of being morally superior to another person. Surprise. And then there is a particular signal for enjoyment, for actual real enjoyment, rather than the social smiles and all that. So I think I've given you seven. And they appear to be the same no matter what your age, culture, race, or sex is. Anywhere in the world.
Why do you care if facial expressions are universal or if they're unique to cultures?
Well, there are practical and theoretical reasons. Practical reason is you need to know whether you do need a Berlitz book when you go traveling abroad to read the expressions of other people. I mean, it was Charles Darwin who really made this discovery. I just got some of the more solid evidence for it. But when Darwin went on his voyage of the Beagle and he traveled for 5 years all over the world to really obscure places, he couldn't understand the languages of the people, but he could understand their emotions. And so a little light bulb clicked. That sort of fit with his developing theory of evolution and the continuity of the species. So if they're universal, practically that means this is something that we can understand in other people without needing a translation. Theoretically, it means that this must be the product of our evolution, and there must be a strong biological component to the phenomena of emotion. It also means that there may well be a link to other animals, as Darwin claimed, and we might even want to entertain the notion that other animals have emotions, not just humans, and maybe that would have an impact on how we treat other animals. So there's lots of different reasons.
In order to confirm that facial expressions were universal and not just inherent to specific cultures, you had to go to isolated cultures, cultures that hadn't been exposed to mass media, cultures in which there weren't tourists coming in from other countries, just to see what are the facial expressions of these isolated people. So what cultures did you choose to study that?
I found a culture in the New Guinea highlands called the South Foray, that was being studied by a pediatric neurologist named Carlton Gajdacek. And he was there because 50% of these people were dying of an unknown disease, and he was trying to track it. And fortunately enough, Gajdacek had taken movie film, over 100,000 feet of film, of these people who had never seen an outsider, and he was willing to lend it to me before I went. And when I watched these films, I mean, it took almost a year to watch them, I was then convinced. Up until then, I was not certain whether Darwin was right or Margaret Mead was right, really the two opposing positions about facial expressions. But if Mead was right, then I should have seen expressions I'd never seen before, which was not the case, or they should have occurred in very different social contexts, which was not the case. So then I set out to go there and do experiments in this Stone Age culture that could actually document the fact that these were universal to our species. And I knew there wasn't much time left. And in point of fact, within 2 years, Western culture had invaded these isolated villages that I worked in.
Give us an example of one of the experiments that you came up with.
Well, one of the virtues, these people, of course, didn't know what a camera was. They'd never seen a photograph. They'd never seen their own face. They'd never seen a mirror. There was no still water that they could look at themselves. So I would set up my camera, and I would go from English to pidgin, and I'd say, tell me what your face would look like if you learned that your child had died. Another one, friends have come up that you like and you haven't seen for a while, or you're angry about to fight. And each time, I mean, if I showed you these pictures, they're in my book if you saw them, you have no problem understanding them. If you heard their language, you wouldn't know what in the world they're saying. Or if you saw their gestures, you wouldn't know what they're talking about. But the facial expressions of emotion are universal.
Now, we can all recognize what anger looks like, but you've actually mapped out the muscles of the face that are used when somebody is displaying anger on their face. What does anger look like from your point of view, having actually codified it?
Well, you know, I developed something that's sort of the equivalent of musical notation for the face. And so it allows us to describe in quantitative terms, because I don't want to use the Latin names, they're too cumbersome. So the prototypic anger expression involves the lowering of the eyebrows and pulling them together, and that's action unit 4. The raising of the upper eyelid, that's action unit 5. The lowering, the tightening of the lower eyelid, that's action unit 7. So we now have a 4-5-7. That's quite sufficient for a very loud anger signal, but you can add to it the narrowing of the red margins of the lip, that's number 23. And then you can either, if you're speaking, your lips will become square, and that's number 22. Or if you're trying to control yourself from speaking, or if you're about to hit somebody, you'll do the same thing. You'll press your lips together firmly, and that's number 24. So in my terminology, it's a 4-5-7-23, let's say 24.
Now, you said it's the lowering of the lower lids and the raising of the upper brows or something?
I went too fast. It's a, in terms of the eyes,
yeah,
the upper eyelid is raised and the lower eyelid is tense simultaneously. That causes the eyes to glare. And if you pull down the brow at the same time, Terry, then you have a very
I'm telling
strong,
you, I can't do it. It's too hard.
Well, not everybody can do it voluntarily. If you were able to do it, and if I coached you and could show it to you, actually, this is one I'm quite confident that with 2 minutes of coaching, because I've done research this way, you'd be able to do this one. And when you did, your heart rate would start to increase. Your blood pressure would go, your blood would go to your hands would get hot. You'd be prepared to hit somebody. Your blood pressure would increase. You would begin to sweat slightly. All the physiological changes that have been adaptive in our ancestral past when we're angry. That doesn't mean that you have to hit anybody. You might make a joke. Depends on what you've learned about how to deal with anger. But evolution's preparing you for what's been most useful in the history of our species.
The other thing is that you're suggesting if you make a certain expression that signifies an emotion, you will respond as if you were having that emotion, even though you're just faking the expression.
That's right. Stanislavski said, make the movement and the feeling will follow. And this is, there are many different ways to access an emotion or trigger an emotion. This is one of the most unexpected ones, that by simply making the muscular movements of one of the universal expressions, if you're able to do all of the movements that are required, then without choice, many of the physiological changes in your brain and in your body that are unique to that emotion will begin to occur.
Let's look at the smile. You've learned to distinguish between the faked or half-hearted smile and the real smile, and it's not based on how far your lips are spread. It's based on the eyes. What have you noticed?
Well, actually, this is not my discovery. I'm just the one who did the research to show that it's correct, and I've extended it a bit. And so I called the true smile of enjoyment the Duchenne smile in honor of Duchenne, Dr. Duchenne, a neurologist who published in 1862, and although Darwin paid attention to it, to him, almost every scientist up until me ignored it, as if the work was never done. And what Duchenne said was that it is the muscle that orbits the eye that does not obey the will, and its absence, I'm giving you the English translation, unmasks the false friend. And he was able to show that by photographing the same person when he told him a joke and when he just simply stimulated the muscle that pulls the lip corners. And it's only in the joke that you, if you like the joke, that you get the muscle that orbits the eyes. But it's a very subtle sign. It's not easy to spot. And where you have to look is in what's technically called the eye cover fold, the skin in between the eyebrows and the upper eyelid, and the inner parts of the eyebrow. And in true enjoyment, they'll move down very slightly.
Now, we all know that, to some extent, we could read people from the expression in their eyes, but you've codified that too.
This is a very subtle sign, which means it hasn't evolved to the point of being easy to recognize. You need to be taught it, and then you have to work hard to see it, which means that probably for most of the time human beings have been on this planet, it was enough to just know that that enjoyment was being shown, and there was no particular advantage to know whether it was true enjoyment or not.
Do you think that lying registers on somebody's face?
Well, I define lies in a way that not everyone does, that a lie is a deliberate attempt to mislead another person without any notification. So you can deceive people in poker, but you can't really lie because everybody knows when you play poker, you're going to bluff. Now, the only lies that you can really read from the face itself, I mean, in my work on deception, we deal with the body and the voice, and the speech as well. But the face will tell us about concealed emotions. So if I said to you, Terry, I'm just having a great time talking to you, but actually I'm really quite worried about how I'm getting across, but I don't want you to see that fear, there might be a micro expression of fear. And that's a concealed emotion. If you like, that's I am lying about how I feel. When Marcia Clark, the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case, was badgering Cato Kalin about whether he had a book contract, which he did, but he was denying, he was lying. There's a beautiful micro-expression. It's just two video fields, 15th of a second, of an enormous snarl. Now, when you show that videotape to people who haven't been trained to spot these, they think he's just feeling fine. They don't see it. But we have the apparatus with to be able to see these micro-expressions. So it's only concealment of emotion that the face can tell us about, not concealment of plans, values, thoughts, opinions.
You have consulted to the CIA and to the FBI. You've done some work on terrorism. We're in a situation now, as a country, we're trying to find terrorists before they commit their next action. What kind of suggestions have you made about how terrorists can be spotted?
Well, this is a hard topic to talk about for a couple of reasons. First, most of the teaching I've done up until 9/11 has been to law enforcement, which is a much easier situation. And most of what I teach law enforcement is how to spot the signs when you're not getting a full account, and in particular, how to identify the truthful person who's under suspicion. Because spotting, in a law enforcement situation, spotting the liar is not very hard. The problem is that there are truthful people who, because they're under suspicion, look like they're lying and can get misjudged and can end up in prison because of that misjudgment, not just by the police, but then by the jury.
What are some of the things that you can look
for?
Well,
let me give you a very concrete example. Your spouse has been murdered. You're going to be the first person interrogated, unless you're out of the country, because just on an actuarial basis, most unfortunately, a high percentage of murders are committed by the spouse. But let's suppose you're truly innocent. You didn't do it, and my God, you're in a state of mourning, and you want your spouse's murderer to be found, and here they are wasting their time and casting aspersions on you, interrogating you, so you're getting very angry. You're also getting a bit afraid. God, are they going to misjudge me? Now, it's likely, at least there are many cases, where you're going to conceal those emotions because you think if you just start attacking these guys, you're going to make things even worse. Now, the untrained law enforcement person would see he would get some kind of intuitive hunch something's wrong. He wouldn't know what's being concealed is anger or fear because he hasn't been trained to be able to spot that specifically or to be alerted to the fact that innocent people often are angry and afraid about being interrogated. So he might, the untrained policeman might mistakenly think, aha, this guy isn't giving me the truth about the crime. It's not about the crime he isn't giving you the truth. He's not giving you the truth about how you feel. If they went through the training specifically on facial expression, they'd be able to see this person's angry and afraid, and they might well then say, listen, am I getting under your skin? Are you getting really angry that I'm asking you these questions? They'd be able to clear this up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Ekman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, and he's the author of the new book, Emotions Revealed, which is based on his extensive research into facial expressions. Do you see something in your face when you look in the mirror that you never saw until you started this research?
No. I don't see anything new in my face. I mean, of course, what I see that's new in my face are wrinkles as I get older, but I don't really see more than I ever saw before. And, of course, I don't get to see my face when it's lively. Other people see it. We don't know what's on our face. The feedback for touch or pain or heat is exquisite on our face, but the feedback that is to be aware of what expression is beginning to emerge or is actually on your face, it's very badly represented in conscious awareness. That's why people often say to you, what's upsetting you? Why are you looking so downcast? And that's the first time you realized you were downcast and you sure didn't know it was on your face. Others see us. We don't see ourselves.
Do you ever get accused of invading people's privacy because you can, or at least they're afraid that you can, know what they're really thinking by reading these micro-expressions?
Well, it certainly is a danger that I'm very aware of. And I've written very explicitly about if once you are able to get information that people aren't really wanting to give to you, they're not volunteering it, you're picking up these very subtle or very brief expressions. In a sense, you're stealing information. Now, what do you do with that to be constructive rather than destructive? And I've discussed that in how you use that in a business setting, how you use that in a family life, and how you use that with friendship. And my main point is you have to really consider, what am I entitled to? If I say to my daughter, how was your day today? And I see a look of sadness on her face, that's very different from as to what I'm going to do, given my relationship with my daughter, which is a very frank one, than from what I would do if I saw that same expression on someone who was just an acquaintance or who was an employee. So I think we need to be very judicious, once we learn how to do this, as to how we use it in a constructive. I think it can be used in a destructive fashion. It's a two-edged sword. By and large, though, my working assumption, which might be wrong, is that we and the world are better off if we understand the emotions we're each feeling at the moment we're feeling them.
Do you think that good politicians, press spokespeople, news anchors, people who are in public positions delivering information, do you think that some of them are particularly kind of gifted at knowing how to use facial expressions or intuitively using them?
Yes, I call those people, I used to call them natural liars, but I changed it because it's too pejorative. And I call them natural performers. Uh-huh. And most of them are people who can become the role they're playing as they play it. And if you believe what you're saying, then of course you're not lying, and you can be very effective. And, I mean, any actor does that. But any good public performer has to be able to do that. So these days, I mean, when I don't think this was, of course, so 100 years ago, but these days you're not going to get into any of the positions that you mentioned unless you are such a performer.
Well, while we're on the subject of politicians, you have, as one of your illustrations in your book, you have a photograph of President Reagan embracing one of the leaders of the NAACP, and this is a woman who had just given a speech very critical of President Reagan, mm-hmm. and he's smiling and embracing her, and you say about the smile that it's a real grin and bear it kind of smile. What are you seeing on Reagan's face that led you to that conclusion?
Yes, it's one of my favorite smiles. It's the smile that any of us give to the dentist when he says that you have to have a root canal and it's going to cost a lot of money and it's going to hurt. And you give them this grin and bear it or miserable smile. And nobody thinks that you're enjoying it, but it's saying, I'm going to go along with this. And this is sort of, in this situation, it's a good sport smile. So he's got a very broad smile, but the crucial thing is that he's pressing his lips together tightly and pushing up his lower lips. This is a smile that former President Clinton used again and again. It almost was a mannerism for President Clinton. He would add one more thing. He'd pull his lip corners down. So that when President Clinton first appeared in the primaries, I guess that was 92 with all the other candidates, I was watching keenly, and he was giving a particular, a variation on this that I thought was the expression of, I've got my hand in the cookie jar and you've caught me. And I said to my wife, this is Peck's bad boy. This is a guy who wants to get caught and have us love him as a rascal. And she said, come on, she said. You don't know what you're talking about. And of course, it did turn out that I was right. That was his Achilles heel.
Do you ever play poker?
I'm not a poker player. The new book about poker I read a review of made me think of, well, do I want to read that? No, if I read that, I might think about playing poker. I did study two of the winners of the International Poker Tournament in Las Vegas. They sought me out because they were hoping I could teach them new tricks. And what they both independently said to me was, the reason why they win at poker is because they can spot bluffs better than other people can. But in poker, the repertoire is very limited. There's no word spoken, and there's just moving chips and picking up cards. And they've developed extraordinary knowledge about what you can read from people and how that's done. But in terms of looking at general aspects of demeanor that I look at during conversation, they were no better than anyone else, but that's not what they're specialized in.
Would you consider it unethical to help poker players read other people's faces so that they could win?
I've never thought about that. I don't know whether that's unethical or not. I would imagine. But you wouldn't need, you know, here's another thing I found out. These guys are so low output. They don't make facial expressions. people who are professional poker players are totally unexpressive. So there wasn't anything I could teach them that would be of help to them because of the people they play with and because of the kinds of clues that they're looking for, which is not things that anyone else ordinarily ever does.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a lot of fun.
Paul Ekman talking with Terry Gross. His new book is called Emotions Revealed: Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. It's published by Times Books.